Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and sitting here with me is Michael, and we have a dark comedy show today.
Yeah, we do.
The podcast double feature.
We're going to do Death to Smoochie and The King of Kong, which is not only a dark comedy,
sort of,
but it's also a documentary.
It is a documentary, yeah. You know, that counts a little less for dark comedy and just more for The King of Kong. Sounds like it needs to go with Death to Smoochie. We were talking before about the show. What do you call those bands?
Doo-wop bands?
Yeah, a lot of these titles sound like 50s fucking doo-wop band. Like, Death to Smoochie and the King of Kong. Like, I don't know. It's weird. Anyways, totally derailing the show here. We're going to have some spoilers in the show itself. We're probably not going to spoil the King of Kong. It's a documentary. You can, you know, tune into that. If you haven't seen it, you owe it to yourself.
Yeah, you really do.
And Death to Smoochie, the title sort of spoils it a little bit there.
Yeah.
But that's one that's kind of a definitive dark comedy movie for us, not for anybody else.
Yeah,
I think
we've
probably mentioned it 1,000 times in the show.
Yeah.
So we're going to get right to that.
The best one.
Before we get to that, there are also chapters inside the show itself.
Yeah.
So you can go up to the chapter menu in iTunes, or, you know, I found out a lot of people use Zunes to listen to the show. I've never actually seen a Zune.
Neither have I.
I don't know how they work. They probably have chapters.
Probably.
Maybe they don't. I don't know if they use AAC. Send us an email if you use a Zune and let us know if the chapters work. It's doublefeatureshow@gmail.com. Having said that, Death to Smoochie is the first film. This is, we've talked about this a couple times on the show before as being the opposite of some of the dark comedies we've watched.
Right.
Whether you, again, I'll get this out of the way because I always go back to black comedy.
Right.
And we always have to make the sort of definition there. But black comedy, dark comedy, black humor, you know, even satire to some effect, all sort of the same thing.
Kind of.
We're going to be talking about that a bit today. And this takes the shady side of something light. We're dealing with children's television,
right?
You know, that whole industry, which is something that seems really light and poppy and whatever. And we're showing the seedy underbelly of that, as opposed to something like, you know, I think most notably we talked about Gremlins last year, which made light of some really dark subject matter. Penn and Teller Get Killed, actually, that whole movie kind of rides on that.
Well, I mean, the title alone.
Yeah.
Like, let's go see a movie called
Exactly. Any of the John Waters stuff, too. Like, a lot of times that in breaking apart taboos, it's dealing with something a lot of people are uptight about or really serious. So it has kind of a dark comedy twist on it. And then The Matador, I think, last year, that Pierce Brosnan film that didn't get any love in our one summary episode. But
it should have probably gotten some love.
It really should have. So yeah, we have the shady side of something light here. And I think that's something you don't see a whole lot. And I don't know if that's just because there aren't enough light subjects to have a seedy underbelly.
I mean, what else could you do with that? That's kind of a sad assumption.
Yeah, it is. It really is, isn't it? So there's a few key elements that I think set this aside as a dark comedy and make it, you know, one of the real notable ones. And I'm going to try and really stand up for this film as like the dark comedy, despite the fact, again, that no one else will think that. And one of the things that I think is the most subtle going into it, and I didn't really notice it until I was actually combing through the film this time when we watched it, looking for these things. But they use the what I'll always refer to as the Penn and Teller bullshit method. You know, when they tackle something on bullshit that's really heavy, they'll put like light, frothy elevator music over it. Most notably, I think of the episode, I want to say it's in season 2, called Death Inc., where they talk about you know, the death industry and the funeral industry, and or when they talk about guns, you know, they go in the gun store and they have this really light shopping music, and that stuff always lightens it up a lot. I think you can get dark comedy just out of that simple formula.
Probably.
Of here are dark things happening,
right?
And you know, here's the light side of that.
Because
you always kind of run the gamut of the dark comedy just being dark and not having comedy,
right?
And I think that comes up most often when you're dealing with the darker subject matter. In Death to Smoochie, you know, you have a couple moments like where Moochie dies,
right?
And if it didn't have that lighter score,
it's not only like the lighter score, but like they put some like really weird dialogue. That,
right,
like, it seems out of place, but I think the reason that, or
it being in there, even though you go, I don't know if that, okay.
Right,
like,
right, yeah.
The reason that it, like, kind of separates you for a second makes the blow a lot lighter.
Yeah, right.
Like,
right.
You have a character who's, like, in all essences, retarded.
Yeah, Skinner, right.
Yeah, the film doesn't say he's retarded, but he's definitely on a lower level right. of intelligence.
Everyone dances around it as hilarity ensues.
Yeah. And he, like, ends up getting beaten up and shot
right.
and killed. And while he's getting beaten up, he's like, uh-oh, what right. round is it?
Right.
And you're like,
and you also have, like, the two, you know, Bugs Bunny thugs
right.
basically hunting him down. And, you know, they come back from that, and that's really funny, too, when they come back to Merv, and they're just like, how are we supposed to know he has a cousin named Smoochie? Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You said kill the purple rhino.
Yeah.
What is it? Smoochie is... Violet,
magenta, Mucci, was that?
Yes, yeah. Smoochie's magenta, Mucci's fuchsia, or the other way around. Right.
Burgundy?
Yeah.
Is there a burgundy in there? Another key element of this as a dark comedy is these kind of absurd moments that you just have to, like, really stand back to soak in what is actually happening. There's a bunch of them in this, but the first one that really gets me is when Robin Williams, you know, he's cast out as Rainbow fucking Randolph.
Yeah.
Which may be the origin of proper fuck placement in character titles.
Yeah.
But when he's cast out and they have, you know, again, the dark moment where you first see the underbelly, you see him come off that show and you don't really know what you're getting from just this opening of this show because it's really cartoony and it's really childish. Mm-hmm. And then you see him making the deal. So you have these two kind of scenes back to back, which tell you exactly what movie this is.
Right.
You have, hey, here's light children's television, here's CD underbelly, and that's exactly what's coming together right. with this film. So it doesn't take you long, like with a film like Brazil that we did, which you could consider a dark comedy, sure. it takes us quite a while. I think when you listen to that show, even we're kind of trying to figure out what's happening as it's going along. And, you know, that's one of the great things about Brazil. Mm-hmm. But with this, you just want to let people get right into it because the only point of this is to be a dark comedy.
Right.
So after he gets fired and all that happens and Edward Norton's character, beautifully played by
Absolutely.
Edward Norton.
All the actors in this, really.
Yeah. So when Smoochie first picks up the time slot and whatever, he decides he's going to sabotage it.
Yeah.
And he does this by baking these cookies. And before we get into that moment, because I think that's another big one for the film, you see him, he's baking cookies over a hobo fire.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, how more absurd do you get than that?
Yeah.
And you almost don't even know what he's doing until your second time around watching it. Because he's just like Robin Williams, that's just his thing. He's full of charisma. And so you're just watching his face and he's just saying all this weird shit. And so you're not even paying attention. But if you look over this like hobo diesel fucking gas fire, he's baking the cookies that are going to show up in the next scene. Yeah. And it's just completely fucking absurd.
And then the next scene, okay, sorry, I don't want to like steal this from you, but there's this thing that I love about this movie. And it's just a line. But it shows like the genius in writing.
Is it Safari motherfucker? Because that's one of the great ones.
It's better
ones.
Than that.
Yeah. Talk about quotable. This is a fantastic one.
It's the scene where I don't fucking remember all of the lines.
Sure.
But they do the healthy cookie song. It's like sweetened with juice for an energy boost.
Right,
and then
exactly.
Robin Williams goes, whatever that means, you fucking peasant.
Yes. Yeah, that's another great line.
I love whatever that means, you fucking peasant.
Yeah, it just assaults you. I mean, that's a lot of the dark comedy stuff, too, is you don't even have time to, like, you just sit back and giggle and go, what does that even fucking mean? And that's what he's asking, too. Just the whole thing is ridiculous. Well, and that leads to another kind of moment, which is almost like the absurd stuff, but I think it's even more, again, it's more of an assault. It's the, oh my God, I can't believe they're doing that moment. And that's the cookie scene.
Yeah, totally.
You know? He pulls out this cookie and it's shaped like a fucking cock.
Yeah.
And you're just like, you know, you see all these children around too, which just heightens the whole thing. And you don't really know if this is live or what's happening.
Well, that's
here.
The drama is that is like, if it
really
were in
is.
Front of a bunch of adults, you'd be like, oh
yeah, a
that's
cock shaped cookie. Right. Right.
But
exactly.
Like he's in front of a bunch of kids and it's funny because that's the dark comedy side.
Yeah.
Like it becomes this dramatic,
right.
Oh no, how's he going to get around a
penis
shaped cookie?
Yeah. And again, brilliant writing. It's a rocket ship.
It's a rocket ship. It's going to fly us to Jungle Land.
Yeah, you can't get a whole lot better than that. And that does a lot of great stuff for the characters, too. You're seeing Rainbow Randolph and the right away the extent he's willing to go to. And what a like fucktard this guy is. I mean, he's so messed up. Which comes back to a great gag at the end.
Yeah.
You know, where he's like knocked out and they ask him if he's okay.
Right.
It's like, well, I'm generally fucked up anyway, so it's hard to gauge. So I wanted to ask you, so we have the cookie moment.
We have the cookie moment.
And that's one, again, every time you watch it, you go, I can't believe they're doing this. Yeah. Even though it's a fictional film, mm-hmm. there's just something so wrong about it. And one of the levels of what's so wrong is that there are really all those children there.
Right.
I mean, you don't think about it on a surface level, but they did actually have to have all of those child actors there. And we have rallied over and over on this show that children are a lot more grown up than we think they are.
Totally.
So like seeing a cookie-shaped penis is not actually going to scar them.
It's more of a penis-shaped cookie.
Well, either one. One would scar them more than the other, I would assume. But that's not actually going to, you know, fuck them up for life or anything. But there is this moment where you kind of go, wow, they really did, you know, the thing that's happening in the film, they really did kind of do that with all those kids on the set that day. They were like, all right, we're all going to look at a penis-shaped cookie.
Right.
So do you think this is kind of a cheat, or do you, because it only uses it once. So I'm willing to say, regardless of your definitive answer, you know, because your opinion on this is clearly what matters
well,
in the
film
industry. Well,
yeah, you're asking me the question instead of the other way around.
They only use it once, so I think they get away with it. But is it cheap to just show something obscene to children and have that be the gag? I mean, is that too easy? Or
you know, I don't think so, especially with this kind of movie.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the movie's about.
Right. I guess in a larger way, that really is the whole movie.
The movie's about exploiting children, and it's just like that's the one scene where, pun completely intended, everything kind of comes to a head right in front of the kids.
Yeah, it certainly does.
But other than that, everything kind of remains behind their back, and they never really see the darkness that is their entertainment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whether it be the Parade of Hope or what happened to Buggy Ding Dong.
Buggy Ding Dong. But what was it? Buggy Bumper?
But his Buggy Bumper, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Buggy Ding Dong. What was the show called? Like, and the...
Well, no, you're thinking of... Oh, well, no, I started thinking of The Whale. What was the guy's
Wally
name?
The Whale.
Wally the Whale. Oh, my God.
How did you do it with Wally the Whale?
So the movie also has some dark turns, and that's the final, you know, if you're going to make a bulleted list, as we have done here, of dark comedy things, I think this is one of the most effective. You could almost ride the whole film out on this. When you have a scene that's set up in a certain way to give you a feeling, this will make sense once I deliver the scene, but I'm gonna set this up.
I'm
for
just
you
gonna
a bit
ignore
here.
What you're gonna say for a little bit.
That's fine. Right. When a scene sets you up where it feels like it's trying to evoke a feeling in you, and in a normal, like, feel goodery fucking in The Replacements, this would be like a bullshit scene where Keanu Reeves comes back to save the team. You're supposed to feel warm and fuzzy.
Never seen that movie.
I was looking for apartments the other day and it was playing at the realtor's office. Anyways, the point is that you know the film is trying to, unless you're like totally just spaced, unless you've never seen a film before, you know that the film is trying to exploit you.
Right.
It's trying to go, hey, this is the part where all the hairs stand up in the back of your neck and you get all teary-eyed. So there's this scene where Rainbow Randolph is trying to light himself on fire.
Mm-hmm.
And from out of nowhere, at the last second, as he's even failing, really, to like try and light a match and, you know, whatever, he gets the match lit and you're like, are they really going to light him on fire? And you go, okay, well, in this movie, it's a dark comedy, so you want him to light himself on fire because that's fucked up. But this girl comes from out of nowhere, this little angelic girl, as he later explains her, you know, his little angel comes out to save him. And goes, you know, what are you doing? And you're supposed to, like, feel this somber thing. And for a second, for just a second, you think Death to Smoochie is totally copped out.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
Hey, it's Smoochie.
Yeah, hey, it's Smoochie. And she runs off. And it's almost worse than if he lit himself on fire. I mean, it extends his agony. It's unexpected. It's just one of those great turning moments that I think is something you can only really capitalize on in a dark comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And just fantastic. The characters are another thing, and we can kind of get into some of them because I know Robin Williams is the real thing
Absolutely.
To talk about here.
Yeah.
But before that, Catherine Keener.
Hot.
Check. And also Merv. So the
Hot.
Character the character of Merv in this.
Yeah.
I mean, this is double feature, so I have to go, look, noir stuff.
Yeah.
But they do shoot a lot of this noir stuff, especially where
blinds and darkness and smoking.
Right.
And
yeah, absolutely. This film gets a little art house every once in a while.
Yeah.
And that's...
I felt a little sick to my stomach every once in a while. I figured that's what it was.
Yeah, that's probably it. You're like, who could I recast this with? You know, here's the thing. If we recast enough noir in the show, we can eventually do Sin City and recast it with classic actors.
Whoa.
So I think we're just building towards that point.
I'm never going to know who...
Yeah, they have a couple, like, Dutch angle scenes, and then they have... the obviously the blind stuff, but I always think of that shot where they're like torturing Merv at the end. You know, they kill Merv, right?
Yeah.
They behead him or whatever. Yeah. So there's that shot where they talk to Smoochie about, you know, what they're going to do, and the camera just kind of pans over, and all of a sudden they're in a dark room with this.
What they did do.
And, you know, it's got that green lighting, and it's the way they make that transition is just seamless, and it's gorgeous. And it's the kind of thing that I think puts this above a lot of your typical, you know, cash-in dark comedies. Even when we look at something like Bad Santa, which was great at what it did, but it was a pretty, you know, typical affair.
Mm-hmm.
You know, excellent at that, but this movie does stuff that it doesn't have to do that.
Right.
There's no reason for it to do a showy kind of shot like that. Mm-hmm. It just decides to. That's right. Part of its, you know, artistic street cred.
It's just amazing. Like, you see these shots, and, like, the score doesn't do it, but in your head, you just hear a saxophone solo.
Right, yeah, you absolutely do. Yeah.
And you're just like, I'm noticing it because you're describing the scene, and I'm going back, and I'm like, oh, yeah, and there's that cool saxophone solo.
Right, yeah, but that's not actually happening. No. And the bluesy detective walks in. No, who walks in is John Stewart.
Right.
Who doesn't get enough recognition in this film either.
Nor is he a bluesy detective.
No, he's not. But one of his few film roles, and I would say clearly his best film role. You know, John Stewart plays like a total stooge in this, and one of the industry executives. But some of his exchanges with Robin Williams are great.
Oh, totally.
But anyways, the reason I mentioned Merv at all is because he is a character that is totally, I mean, as much as Robin Williams will play his part and Edward Norton goes his direction and Catherine Keener, these guys are all showing up and giving it their A game. Merv is so deadpan. He doesn't know that he's in a funny film.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There is no like kitschy nod and wink bullshit here at all.
Right.
He is really out to get the rhino, you know, and he's got that raspy voice, and they shoot him in silhouette and just all of his stuff. Having dark characters to play off
of. Oysters on a half shell.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Really,
it's probably a swanky jazz club, right?
It's like a Disney bad guy at that point.
Yeah, it really is. Like, yeah, it absolutely is.
When he's like
is.
Eating grody food and like putting more grody food on it, and he's like slurping it, and he's like, kill the rhino.
Right. And, you know, what makes that funny is that's all just build up for scene. You know, I know the scene comes earlier, but scenes like where they're in the car and he's just like, the Parade of Hope is here to offer this and this and this. And you're just like, wow, this guy is just oozing with
the line, I think the line is, hi, I represent the Parade of Hope. Oh yeah, you help children build orphanages. We've been known to add a brick or two anyway.
Yeah, right. Which is before the scene, which is another one of those absurdist kind of moments, or I think it even borders on can't believe this is happening, which is Smooch Heil.
Smooch Heil.
Yeah, which we can't go through this show without saying that.
Oh my God, the rhino's a Nazi.
The rhino's a Nazi.
That's the line during the Robin Williams dance scene.
Right, so to get to Robin Williams.
Yeah, that's why I said that. That was my segue.
That was an excellent segue. So talk to me about Robin fucking Williams.
So Robin fucking Williams is...
who we've seen previously in What Dreams May Come.
And Insomnia.
Oh, we did see him in Insomnia. He's good in one of those movies.
The thing about Robin Williams is he's a comedian first and foremost.
Yes.
And he doesn't sleep.
Right. Those are the two things.
And
The Aristocrats as well.
He's been in a million movies,
as we're demonstrating right now.
He's played lead roles, he's played minor parts, he's been the good guy, he's been the bad guy,
he's been Patch Adams,
he's been a man from the jungle in a board game.
Oh God, like, please stop.
He's been all over the place,
right?
But the one thing about Robin Williams is when he's good,
yeah,
he's really good.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, Robin Williams does not get better than this role.
No, absolutely not.
You know, and it's weird because this started a moment in his career where he kind of went through some dark fit. You know, we did 1 hour photo around this time, Final Cut, which is a film that gets weird and so no one ever talked about it again, but both very dark films.
Well, because he had
not dark comedies, like just dark fucking
roles. He had the stint where he was kind of like a family actor. Hook, I think, was the definitive.
I love
Hook, and we're going to cover that later this year, but... that was the definitive role in his like family pointed career.
Well, and he's kind of come back around to that.
We're just going to tag all his movies. Look at his IMDb.
Do you want to put that in there?
No, but now we have to.
All right. Are we done listing the Robin Williams IMDb page?
I think so.
Okay.
But Robin Williams in this movie, as you said, definitive best role of his career that I've seen.
How can you get better than Rainbow Randall?
You can't.
I mean, this isn't, I don't know that I want to say this character has nuance, but I mean, definitely, you're not going to forget it. Yeah. Rainbow fucking Randolph. Yeah. Just don't forget this guy.
The reason I like it is because he had this family-oriented stint.
Right.
But meanwhile, in his career, he had his quote-unquote seedy underbelly, which was his comedy career, because he's not a clean comedian.
No, not by any means.
And so you have this guy, and he's like, oh, I'm fucking Barney.
Yeah.
And then, like, turn around, and he's like, you know,
doing blow into Catch a Rising Star.
Exactly.
Yeah, and there are moments, and this is for better or for worse in a lot of movies, and why I have a hard time dealing with Robin Williams, because he's kind of got the Crispin Glover directorial style, where he shows up, he straps on his codpiece, and you just don't mess with him for the rest of the shoot. Robin Williams, like,
you tell him his name.
Yeah, he's uncaged a lot of times.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't really like improv stuff. I mean, we've talked about that before.
It usually stands out against
the
film. Yeah,
right. I like stuff that's really well written and thought out, and where I can praise a writer for something. And you can do that in this film, and you can also have these moments that are clearly Robin Williams ad-libbing, but he understands this character so well that he can go off on stuff, and it works perfectly for the film.
It does.
Also, I'm just glad that they rail against eye shows in this, because eye shows are probably the most despicable fucking evil thing that man has ever created.
I would say that eye shows, just like kids-related eye shows, are probably one of the two most evil things on Earth. Yeah, well, the other one is Billy Mitchell.
Oh, yeah. So, the King of Kong. Before we get into Billy Mitchell, I just want to preface this, because a lot of people listen to the documentary stuff and they don't actually watch the thing. We used to rally against that, but now with literally tens of people listening to the show, I just know that people don't watch the films. So, little background, King of Kong is a film. How would you describe The King of Kong?
Okay, so here's the thing that's weird about The King of Kong. It's a documentary, and it's hilarious,
right?
But it has no outside commentary.
No, it really
doesn't. You have the kind of thing
where
you'll do documentaries, and you'll, like, here's a really good example. Bullshit, the TV show.
Yes.
You film people, they're giving their straight opinion, exactly what they believe, and then you spin it and make them look like an idiot.
Right. Well, I don't want to use the word spin, right?
You don't spin it, but you talk. You talk and give your opinion and kind of like...
You point it. You show your own bias, which is something we've called for
before. Then you give it a funny score and you use the narrator to show your opinion of what they're saying.
Right, absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. We've seen that with documentaries like The God Who Wasn't There, which is almost all, you know, the narrator walking you through it. So that totally rests on Brian Fleming to put that together and tell that story. Or even something like Michael Moore Hates America, which is very personal, but very, you know, it's voiceover. Yeah. This uses totally different style.
All it does is it interviews people. It interviews people in straight, like, as far as I noticed, I'm not going to say because I can't verify, but they don't cut people's, like, words up much.
Sure, right.
But you still know that the person making the movie is laughing at it.
There's this weird kind of almost theater of the absurd element to this, where you're looking at it and you're going, these people are talking about a video game.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's our plot mechanic here. I mean, this almost reads like a fictional film in the same way that, you know, we talked about Murderball almost playing out like a fictitious film in the way that it is so well crafted.
And the thing that's really, really, like, interesting and hilarious, it can't be said enough that this is the best documentary I've ever seen.
Yes. Okay. I'd go that far.
It does that using subtle stuff that instead of asking the right questions, they just rail against the wrong ones. Like, they don't go, so what do you do for a living?
Yeah.
They go, what is your high score?
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
Like, you don't get the background on any fucking person unless they have a silly background.
Well, and here's the thing is most of these guys tell their own backgrounds.
Yeah. Well, they're all so proud to be in front of the camera.
Well, it's weird. We see so many parallels with this in Murderball because Murderball is, after all, a sports film. I think those guys are really atypical of what you see, you know, in sports.
Right.
Whereas these guys are contenders of the truest nature.
But the thing is, like, they feel like they've never been recognized.
Right.
Like, there are characters whose whole purpose is their spotlight.
It's the right
10
now,
minutes.
The film.
And that's why it's funny. You get all these people who their whole lives have wanted the 10 minutes that they feel like they've deserved.
Yeah.
And you give it to them and they're like, okay, I wrote this song.
Yeah,
and it goes like this. Normally there's like 10 vocals and it's really crazy. Kind of like Journey.
Well, come on. What about Roy Schiltz, Mr. Awesome?
Yeah.
Like, that guy is what you're describing right now.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, this is, you know, drives the awesome mobile and has this fucking weird tape. Yeah. And
Brian Koo is the one that I despise. Brian Koo. Not well, because, nobody as much as Billy Mitchell.
Well, I despise him in the way that I feel so bad for this guy. Yeah. Because this guy's like, oh, you're not making a film about me. I'm trying to get a score. Do you want to hear about my score?
But Brian Koo is such a tool.
Yeah,
not only is he a tool, but like we've seen documentaries and everybody in their life has met someone who's a tool.
Right.
But the thing about Brian Koo is he's the tool of the biggest tool on earth,
which is Billy Mitchell. We've been skating around Billy Mitchell so much, but it's just time to talk about this guy. We'll come back to all the fancy pantsy documentary bullshit here, but Billy Mitchell is one of the most despicable characters in nonfiction.
Absolutely.
I mean, like, how,
oh my God.
You know, and especially that's another testament to what we're talking about here. And we look at it right now from this like kind of laughable haha we're talking about video games thing, but I think it goes a lot bigger than that. We'll get to that. But one of the things that makes you realize that is that Billy Mitchell can be such a despicable character, and we're still just talking about the high score in Donkey Kong. I mean, well, that's what this documentary is about.
That's what makes him such a bad person.
Right.
Like, it's because he's an asshole and a total, like, shady, elitist motherfucker.
Yeah.
Because he has the high score in classic arcade Donkey Kong.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
That's and he's taken that so far on his own, like, in his head, that makes him like the king of this like little land of gamers.
Of Donkey Kong, yeah. Right. Well, and they talk about, you know, the tagline for this movie is the true underdog story, or mm-hmm. a true underdog story. And I don't know if a tagline has ever been like so awesome ever, except maybe you see it with the one you fuck, which is the Soderbergh
girlfriend experience,
which I feel bad saying because it's not fuck. It's like it's
see
four,
it with the one
four
you
asterisks.
Quadruple asterisk.
So I feel bad even saying, I just love it. Anyways, it doesn't matter. No, but it is an underdog story.
It is.
I mean, Steve Wiebe is the average guy.
Yeah.
I mean, he is the most like honest. We talked about the president you want to have a beer with last year on What the Fuck documentary. I don't even know which one. Oh, Fuckadotos.
Yeah.
You know, and figuring out what's wrong with the whole creationism evolution thing and why creationism has the upper hand.
Right.
Is they're nice guys.
Yeah.
And here we have like the nicest guy of all time going against Billy Mitchell, who is pure unadulterated evil.
And here's the thing that really hits the nail on the head with the true underdog story. And you said he's like the most average guy.
Sure.
And he is. He has a teaching job at a school.
After getting laid off from his other job and trying to find himself.
He's never really been like in the spotlight for anything.
Right.
And he's going against somebody who's been in the spotlight since he was 18.
Yeah. Yeah.
The same spotlight and milking it since he was 18.
Well, and so to get back to, you know, this is like, it's like a weird Star Wars thing. It's like you always want to talk about Darth Vader because you just can't believe how fucking evil he is. And as much as Steve Wiebe is a great character, and he almost just serves, you know, to look at this as fiction almost, he just kind of serves to make Billy Mitchell that more evil.
Mm-hmm.
This is a guy who has his own hot sauce business.
Yeah.
And they talk about him conducting his business.
And his parents, blow up his ego.
Yeah, they really do. And he's been infatuated with his score, and like, he doesn't even, you know, he's not Mr. Awesome, where there's almost a sense of irony, almost.
Yeah.
He's just like, well, I am the best.
Yeah.
Well, here's why I'm, you know,
and he's a cheater.
Yeah.
He's a fucking cheater.
Well, we'll get to that. Billy Mitchell is always the guy in my head. Like, so I run awesomestart.com, and while a lot of people there like work there and add stuff, I always tell myself as like the actual owner of that business, don't be Billy Mitchell.
Yeah.
That is my guideline to anyone else thinking of starting up a small business or working, you know, in that.
Doing anything.
Yeah. I always just go, I guess that's just a greater idea for, that's the moral of the story of this film, really.
Yeah.
For anything you do is just don't be Billy Mitchell. I don't want to be that business owner who stands around while the other people are cooking and is just like, see this tie? What do you think about this tie?
Yeah.
See, it's got America on it. Yeah. I love America. Like, oh God, he's just terrible. Yeah. But
you know,
so there's,
you know what my initials are?
TIE.
You know what my initials are?
Yeah,
right here. He like
stroking
strokes
your
his
imaginary tie.
Yeah. He's like TIE. No, no.
see this?
What was I wearing yesterday?
Yeah,
what was I? Oh, USA.
USA.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I'm Billy Mitchell.
So why don't we talk about the allegations of cheating? Because that's almost glossed over. They kind of let it go.
Yeah.
Especially after, you know, you have a similar incident where you see how much work. This is, again, this is all documentary making craft to show these events in this order. you show how Steve Wiebe kind of got cheated out of his score.
He beat, not only did he beat Billy Mitchell's like top score of all time, he beat the second score that Billy Mitchell then sent in.
Right. Well, to backtrack, he beats the score in his garage, but because he gets a special board from Roy Schultz, you know, the guy sends him a board because he hates Billy Mitchell
too. Yeah, he wants him to beat him.
The fucking enemy of my enemy seems to be my friend in this scenario, although I don't agree with that shit, and this is a perfect example of why the enemy of my enemy is not, you know, my friend. So he's seen as in cahoots with Roy, who's got a bad reputation. Yeah. And so they don't allow his score to be submitted.
And the only reason that that matters is because Billy Mitchell has more friends.
Yeah.
If Roy Schultz was the guy and Billy Mitchell was the guy who was against the one that everybody liked, then they'd be like, oh, wow.
Yeah, exactly. You did it. Well, and at the end of the film, that's what you kind of see happening is they kind of go, man, I'm sorry we didn't admit those scores. And so because Billy's been around so long, he's able to just turn in these tapes.
Yeah.
So whereas that didn't work at all for Steve earlier in the film, they, you know, and you kind of feel bad for him, but you're like, well, I guess those are the rules, whatever. Then Billy does it, and he essentially talks them in to allowing the score.
Yeah, well, not even talks them into it. They just, like, there's this scene where Billy Mitchell sends in this tape, which is more valuable than anybody's life.
Sure.
And he's serious.
Yeah.
He's not kidding when he says that.
Again, as we talked about with Death to Smoochie, there is no irony here at all.
He's the Merv. Yeah. Everybody else is kind of like, oh, you have video games? And he's like, no, I'm serious. Yeah. I'm Billy Mitchell.
Well, he tells two different people the same stupid line about, you can lose your luggage, but don't lose your tape. You can lose your life, but do not lose the tape.
Yeah, and he's not joking. That's not like a silly, funny joke.
No.
So he sends in this tape, and it arrives at, was it Fun World?
Fun Spot.
Arrives at Fun Spot, and the referee guy, whose name escapes me, shows it. And he watches it, and the whole time on the left side of the screen, mind you, if you've ever played Donkey Kong, the left side of the screen is where the score bar
is. We should also mention, because we're not going to get a chance to actually talk about video games, because we do that every other show. Donkey Kong consensus opinion, really fucking hard.
Hard as fuck.
Yeah, I've never gotten... I play a lot of video games, never gotten past the first screen. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
After it eats like $6 in quarters from me, and I don't get halfway up the first screen, I'm like, fuck this game. I'm going to go play Marvel vs. Capcom 2.
So it's this video of Billy Mitchell's breaking a million Donkey Kong score. And the whole time, the left side of the screen,
I don't know if
all,
it's the whole time or right when it... Because all they show in the film is the transition.
Yeah, but every time, or multiple times, like there's like a weird tracking overlay because it's on a VHS.
Right.
And suddenly the score is higher.
Yeah.
And eventually when he like approaches a million, there's like a weird blip and then he's at a million.
Yeah. And I don't know if I, you know, we don't million, have all the evidence.
Right.
And so the, I'm not going to say for sure he's cheating, but I think what transpires after that is the most interesting thing, because you have him go, hey, did you see that tape?
Yeah.
And we don't know exactly how the phone call goes, but essentially it just sounds like he's like, hey, my tape's cool. Right. And the other dude's like, so are you submitting this for a score or what? He's like, well, looks pretty good, right? Looks like a good tape, right?
Yeah.
And so he has this weird hesitation about submitting it, and you don't ever know if it's because it's fucking rigged or because he just, you know, you don't submit tape scores. That makes you a total pussy.
Right.
Like, you come out to Fun Spot and you do it in person. And the thing about that is that eventually they accept his score. They ask the great line of questioning. They go, so this is obviously a copy of the master, right?
Yeah.
You know? So, so you have the master? Okay, well, as long as you have it, they don't ask for it.
You have a master, like, right? Because this had like, there's kind of weird at one spot. And he's like, oh, yeah, no, I got it. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, totally. Record.
Well, I feel like he talks him into like, oh, aren't you going to go over to the computer? I guess you should go to the computer and update that, shouldn't you? So that just makes the guy despicable. But I think, do you have any more despicable Billy Mitchell components in this film? Because I think there's one more that's really standing out to me.
Well, there's the van when he just kind of like pulls by and he won't let people talk to him.
Right.
Because he's all like celebrity and he's got like spies in the gaming community for him.
Well, and then he doesn't show up in his own restaurant when they're there because he's afraid of Steve Wiebe.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't want to, it's just awkward for him and he doesn't want that kind of pressure. I don't know that I'd say he's that afraid of the score being beaten. It's not like that. I mean, he is.
Well, I think he's terrified. Honestly, I think that's all he has.
I think he's just afraid of the confrontation.
I think that's all.
Everybody's been kissing this guy's ass for so long, and now finally someone shows up and, like,
well, yeah, and
the mysterious contender.
That's what I mean. Like, what if the mysterious contender is to beat his record?
Yeah.
Then what does he have?
Yeah.
He has a successful hot sauce business, but that doesn't apparently doesn't matter.
And a bunch of American ties.
Yeah. Like, that's not important to him. What's important is to be the biggest celebrity on earth.
Of Donkey Kong.
Yeah. And he would lose that, and he doesn't want to meet the guy that could possibly put him out of all his fame.
Well, so the shadiest point for me, like, I could buy maybe that, because anytime I'm watching a documentary, even if I'm totally on the side of the film like I am with this one, I kind of go, all right, well, how are they crafting this story? And maybe it's just because I'm interested in filmmaking,
sure,
or whatever, but whatever. I go, all right, this story is a little too good. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that's how I felt about Murder Ball. And after talking to Dan Adam Shapiro, yeah, we found out that they really just fucking lucked out. But I just feel like, okay, so these elements are all coming together very conveniently. Can Billy Mitchell really be this bad of a guy, or are they painting him that way? But then you get, like, irrefutable proof when they have the big, you know, Detroit show, and of course Steve Wiebe comes out, and, you know, they do it, you know, right by this guy's house or whatever, and he's not showing up, he doesn't show up for a couple of days, and you're like, all right, so maybe before he had real scheduling conflicts, he runs a business, I don't know. But there is literally no excuse for him not to come this time.
Yeah.
And I could buy that maybe it's coincidence all this time that they never meet, he never shows up to the events. Maybe he's not a shady prick. But you see him finally show up on the third day after everyone goes, dude, you have to show up to this.
Yeah.
Like, you just can't stay at home. You have to be here. He shows up with his wife, and who says she's never seen him, you know, compete in Donkey Kong. And he walks by Steve Wiebe. They're in the same room. And this is, like, the most tension in anything I've ever seen. Like, documentaries don't get this tense ever. And this moment's just perfect. And he just walks right by him.
And, well, he says that thing to his wife. He's like, well, there's some people I don't want to spend too much time
with. Yeah. Can you believe that shit? And, I mean, come on. This is, like, this is the villain climax here. And he eventually walks out, and aside from maybe mumbling something as he passes by, he doesn't say shit to Steve. Mm. He sees him there at Donkey Kong. Everybody goes, hey, that's Steve over there. And he doesn't say anything. He looks the other way as he walks by him. I mean, how more cowardly could you possibly be? You can't.
Yeah.
I mean, that is it. Like, oh, just despicable. And then, of course, you know, Steve doesn't make the score. And so you're left on this total downer note. But they have this great moment, you know, right before the
film.
Right. They have the little wrap-up bit at the end over the Saber Dance, I guess is what that song is, and where it's showing the score climbing and climbing, and you know where this is. You know, as soon as the screen pops up, you know where this is going, and it just shows him in his garage. And really, I mean, these guys are going to be back and forth, I'm sure, but at least you get this triumphant moment at the end that they so lucked out that he did finally make the score and beat him. Which, I mean, you almost don't believe that it's going to end with that letdown,
and
I'm
just
so
that,
glad you get that.
It's fucking hilarious because there's the thing where his kid, like, is shouting at him. He's like, hold on, come out here, bring me some toilet paper.
Right. Well, that's the one from earlier in the film when he first submits the tape.
Right.
They have to review it, and they're like, haha, his kid's on there. But yeah, you finally get the end moment where, you know, he does beat him. So on the surface, this is about Donkey Kong.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I don't want to get, like, too highbrow and artsy with this, but I really do think this is about competition.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the fact that they use Donkey Kong as kind of the medium to talk about this, it shows you that, you know, this could have been a football movie, right? This could have been a baseball championship movie.
Sure. It could have been Murder Ball.
This could have been Murder Ball. You know, Murder Ball, thankfully, didn't take the typical sports direction and went a totally different place and was fantastic for doing
that. Well, that's the best way to make a documentary that's about sports more about the people than the sport is if you don't know how the sport's played, you can't watch them play and be like, oh, get it.
Yeah,
because you don't know, like, what they can fucking do.
This does the other thing. This treats it like it's the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is the playoffs. Like, it's, I don't know anything about sports. Is that obvious?
It's the Olympic playoffs.
Okay. And so rather than distracting you with all this sports shit, which you may or may not care about, it gives you this story that really is about people and competition by using the sports formula and applying it to video games. So people who are maybe into video games or people who are into sports or whatever can find this story about human competition that says so much about what players are and what naturally is just, like, in the human psyche that causes people to act in a certain way. And it plays that out through Donkey Kong. I mean, you see it all. You see people who are egotistical. You see the newcomer to the sport. You see the sport being played. You see the stakes. I mean, there's so many times where you see the stakes in this. The original tape, the first time he goes to Fun Spot. You see it with the Guinness Book of World Records. It's like, this is legitimizing the sport. Now it is a sport. It's in the Guinness Book. And you see all of the human drama to this. You see his wife break down in tears. And although you might have got that at the beginning and kind of laughed at it, because you are laughing at these people for a while in this film. And I don't think it's until you kind of see, well, until you see Steve as a character. And then you kind of really start to feel like, hey, there's some normal people in here.
Yeah.
They're not all, because he's the only one who's not a fucking nut job, yeah, right? Because he's really not exposed to this.
Mm-hmm.
These guys, and that's why I always worry about groupthink. These guys all surround themselves with hardcore gamers. And as much as I love hardcore gaming and I love like kind of being a part of that, these guys are nut jobs.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them are just completely batty. And it's like they haven't left Fun Spot for 20 years and they don't know, you know, that.
Yeah, it was Brian Koo was the one who just retired and then went to Fun Spot every day.
Yeah, he retired at 30 and he just hangs out at Fun Spot, I think. And so you see Steve come in as a normal person. And by the time you see his wife break down, you go, wow, this is really like, it doesn't matter that this isn't football, because at the end of the day, and that's another, not to keep bringing this back to Penn and Teller for some reason, but you saw the video game episode of Bullshit.
Yeah.
And I mean, that makes the great comparison for a totally different reason. It's talking about video game violence and banning, but how is it different than football? And had it been, you know, had video games come first, football might be the thing surrounded with controversy today. It's a great episode. Everyone should go see that. This is sort of the same thing in that, there's no reason that this isn't identical to a competitive sport like football. These guys are just as invested. There is just as much drama on the playing field. And I think by breaking down that medium and showing, not only, you know, getting gamers into it in that way, but showing something people aren't as familiar with, fucking Donkey Kong, an obscure thing. This could have been about, you know, any obscure kind of sport. You get to connect to a lot of those kind of emotions and that drama and all of those elements of it a lot faster, and you don't have to weed through the bullshit of an organized sport that you don't care about.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, now that we've ended on the, you know, weekly double feature sports note, why don't we move into the sports that we'll be covering?
We're not doing sports. We're doing something that's been a long time coming.
Yeah, really, it has.
We have, you know, we've talked about before on the show how the great Tarantino-Rodriguez pairing has inspired the show. And I think it's about time we finally get the mashup of all time.
Yeah.
We get the back-to-back. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, I don't think we even need to say the titles. You're going to tune in next fucking week. Do your homework. You know, go watch the Tarantino film. Go watch the Rodriguez film. Do them back-to-back, as I believe they're meant to be done, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's why they came out together.
Yeah.
That's, you know.
There's no reason.
Like, weird separated distribution aside, people, like, you're supposed to see these films back-to-back, and we're going to fucking do
trailers included, by
finally,
the way,
next week. Until then, head to the great new double feature show.com. You can do a bunch of crazy shit over there. Leave us a review on iTunes or send us any emails you might want to send for whatever reason at doublefeatureshow@gmail.com. And that is officially the end of this podcast.
Watch more fucking film.
Bye.